You might not realize it, but we are exposed to dozens of hazards every day. Can any of these hazards negatively impact your health? Definitely. This is the Exposure Scientist Podcast. My name is Alex LeBeau, and here we answer your questions and concerns on what you may be exposed to every day. Welcome to the Exposure Scientist Podcast. The views expressed in this podcast may not be those of the host or management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered health advice. It is recommended that you consult an exposure scientist to discuss the particulars of your exposure scenario. Welcome to today's episode of the Exposure Scientist Podcast. My guest today is Dan Christensen. Dan is the Director of Sales at Bureau Veritas Industrial Hygiene Laboratory Services. So Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
Of course, like I always like to ask my guests, please tell me about yourself. You're an industrial hygienist. You're working in a laboratory. Please tell us a little about your experience.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. This is one of those fields that you didn't know it existed until you were introduced to it, right? Like,
that's correct.
No kid in kindergarten's like, I want to be an industrial hygienist when I grow up. So, you know, I don't even know where to start. I guess I wasn't a great high school student, but mostly just because I wasn't interested in most of what was being taught, because it was all, I don't know, it's just background and theory. I mean, I had things I liked. I always excelled in the sciences. I did my best to keep up in math with my peers, just because I always had a bit of a if you can do it, I can do it, kind of, you know, like there's no reason why you're better than me, so I can take that same class. And, you know, I applied myself about as much as I was interested. So, but I always had in the back of my mind, because my dad was a military guy, that growing up as an Army brat, you always have in the back of your mind, well, I'm going to go in the military. And I ended up not. And I struggled to find that interest in going to college, just couldn't see why. And so I ended up just doing a whole bunch of stuff. I've always been a worker. So like when I was 11 and I needed money, I started delivering newspapers before school. And, you know, I spent most of my summers in high school printing t-shirts in a, you know, unair conditioned warehouse in Arizona, you know, so really getting that kind of hands-on working experience. And then after high school, I went into construction. So I was confident in my ability to do things. Ironically, I was experiencing some things. Like when I printed t-shirts, you washed the ink with mineral spirits. You just had this tank in the back that was like where the new person had to, scrub the ink off of all the screens and everything and do all the cleanup. And, you know, you're just covered in mineral spirits. And as a kid, I don't know. I guess it's okay.
Right.
But, you know, then I worked construction. I fell off a roof. You know, I cut myself 100 different ways. And so I kind of learned by hands-on experience some of these things that we look at in the occupational health space and safety space. So by the time I found myself in college in my mid-20s, you know, my girlfriend, soon to be my wife, you know, started to kind of solidify on how I needed to find something in life that was going to be more than an hourly job. And I had a roommate who was an engineer. So of course I was, you know, geared towards engineering, because if he can do it, why can't I do it? And right. I was in the civil and environmental program, but I also worked. I never stopped working. So I was working in factories and foundries, and so I struggled to keep up with the course load, quite honestly. I just didn't have time for the homework. I finished school and went and worked the late shift, you know, until 2 a.m. So I went and talked to a dean, and he said, you know, with your science background and the credits you've got, go talk to these guys in the biology building. And I went over there and I passed a copy of the Industrial Hygiene News that was posted up on the wall. And it was the salary survey, and it said, you know, certified, or it said civil engineer, X amount of dollars per year. And then right under it, it said industrial hygienist, same amount. And I'm like, whoa, these guys make as much as starting civil engineers. So, okay, maybe this isn't, you know, because I was having kind of a morose walk from the the nice engineering building over to the decrepit biology building,
right? You know,
the building everyone avoided on campus. And I fell right into it because I had those industrial experiences, you know, mm-hmm. noise and welding and, you know, construction and safety, all that stuff. And so it was just like water off a duck's back when I got into class. Plus I was, you know, 5 to 7 years older than most of the people in there. So I'd had some life experience. Long story short, I graduated very motivated to move on in the field. And my internship in school had been through copper mining. So I was exposed to, again, another industry you don't know exists unless you're brought up around it. Mining. Who in the U.S. thinks about a career in mining?
Right.
And so I was recruited by a mining company based out of Australia, and they had a coal operation in New Mexico. From there, I got my cut my teeth on being an industrial hygienist, and then exposure to not just U.S. regs and compliance, which is pretty much what we were taught in school, but then really having to jump into the world of ACGIH and international standards, because the company based in Australia obviously operated to some different industrial hygiene rules. So that really got me going. I had also bought into the idea of getting certified as a CIH as quickly as possible. But without really a mentor, I kind of had to develop my own path. So I did the OHST in the first 2 years after graduation. Then I started on the CSP track because I could get into it earlier. So I got the ASP, the CSP, and then as soon as I was able to take the CIH exam, I took it. I did not pass it the first time, as most people don't. But eventually passed it. And by that time, I had moved to the petroleum world. I'd done a bunch of offshore and onshore oil and gas. And then a consultant that I had hired had an opening for a director in their consulting division of their emergency response company. And I moved to Arkansas and I led that industrial hygiene group for 6 years. And that was really, really mind expanding because before I was industry focused.
Right.
And now it was industrial hygiene focused, which was, you know, a call could come from anybody for anything at any time. And I had a great time there growing people, taking brand new people out of school, taking people who didn't have any industrial hygiene background, and just, you know, trial by fire. You know, I took a kid to the OSHA oil and gas conference. He just hired on, had a master's in biology, didn't even know the words industrial hygiene. And I had him standing at the booth with me, and a guy comes up and he's like, "So tell me about your capabilities with noise, assessment." And I'm like, "Well, you're in luck because Justin here is our noise expert." You know, and I let him stumble around for about 15 seconds, but it was really to kind of say, this is the kind of stuff people are going to ask us. This is the kind of stuff we've got to know, and we've got to be able to respond. And so that right. really, you know, set the mindset of how quickly you need to get up to speed with this stuff. And we're not going to hold your hand. And it worked out great. That kid's gone on to a different company. He's like a senior industrial hygienist now. You know, so I mean, what a cool story to be involved in something like that.
Right. To be able to mentor somebody. I completely agree.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. I got there and there was a guy who didn't know it, but he was a better industrial hygienist than I was. And he was not being compensated to the level he probably should have been. So I was at high risk of losing the best hygienist on my team if somebody came along with a better offer. Mm-hmm. And I really had no levers to pull for giving him a significant increase unless he got his CIH. And I was like, "Dude, just sit for the certified industrial hygiene exam." "Oh, I don't know. It's not my field." I'm like, no, it's your field. Trust me. Here's the study material. Study it, take it, run with it. And you're not going to pass. Okay. But it's going to tell you what you need to study for next time. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened. He took it. He didn't pass. And it told him the areas he needed to study. He studied them. He passed. Now he's got the credential to go with that great field experience that he had, and he's a fantastic industrial hygienist. Right. So I really love that. What I didn't love was the emergency response side, where you had to jump out, you know, pick up the phone and then leave, and you didn't know when you were coming back.
That's hard. I mean, I've done that. You need to be ready within 24 hours or be somewhere within 24 hours. Yeah. It's hard. It really is.
Catch the last flight out of Little Rock to DC, right? Mm-hmm. Like the samples are arriving at 10 in the morning. You better be there, you know, like, right. So yeah, I mean, but it was great experience. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I was just watching the news about that Baltimore bridge collapse. Mm-hmm. And, the captain of the port, of course, is running it because it's the ship channel in Baltimore. I worked as the safety officer on a ship collision in the Houston port channel and worked in an ICS underneath the ship, the port captain, you know, Coast Guard captain there, and got to see that for 20 something days. And that was an amazing experience. So kind of reflecting on that, you know, reading today's news. And, then I looked for something a little more stable. I got a wild hair. I put in for a job on LinkedIn that was in Switzerland. They called me the next day. Took quite a few months to move over there with all the approvals because I actually had to immigrate to Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that, with my family, COVID broke out. I sent them back here to the house in Arkansas. And then I spent 3 years traveling back and forth between Switzerland and the U.S., and when all COVID finally wrapped up, I couldn't see us moving over there permanently. So much had changed. So I started looking for work back here in the States. That's how I ended up with Bureau Veritas, which was a great opportunity because how many hygienists get hired into a pure sales role?
Yeah.
So again, it was this great opportunity to just do something completely different, but also related. And, you know, it fit in that niche of doing something new and different and, you know, that right. ever learning kind of growing thing that I've got going on.
It's a new challenge, but still helping industrial hygienists in your current role.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I brought Dan on today, and thank you for giving us kind of your background. I brought Dan on to kind of talk about the current state of industrial hygiene. He's had a lot of experience, industrial experience, consulting experience, practical application, and now from the laboratory side. So I kind of want Dan to kind of give us an idea of where he sees from his previous experience the current state of industrial hygiene. So based on your professional experience and how it's kind of shaped your view of industrial hygiene, how do you kind of currently see the field? You know, how do you currently view OSHA's interactions in the field from protecting health versus protecting safety within the workplace? Exposure science covers a broad subject area, including toxicology, industrial hygiene, and risk assessment. From occupational, community, or environmental exposure, exposure scientists apply scientific methodologies to understand exposure risks and apply controls when necessary. We at Exposure Assessment Consulting have this expertise. Please reach out to us at info@exposureconsulting.com for a free 15-minute consultation to discuss the specifics of your exposure scenario.
So I'll throw OSHA a bone here. They're not the best funded organization of the government. So I think that they operate best where I think the political winds are blowing at the time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's been my experience that a lot of government action is reaction, you know. Department of Homeland Security came about because our existing agencies couldn't talk to each other enough to prevent a terrorist attack. You know, so, you know, when there's outrage around something on the health side, and I cut my teeth early on the in the mining side, so I kind of think of MSHA a lot more than I think of OSHA, but MSHA is even less respected and funded.
I was
going to
say, and I think they have been minimized even more so than OSHA in recent years.
Right, right. And what it takes for MSHA to be able to do anything is some sort of like national tragedy. And it's often said in a little bit of dark humor that, you know, every MSHA regulation is written in blood. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that because it takes even on the OSHA side, if you look, the yesterday's history was the triangle shirt, shirt waist fire in the early 1900s that, that killed 145 immigrant, mostly women workers in a garment factory in New York. Right. And there were chained up doors and stairwells and, you know, fire escapes didn't work. And so all these safety related things, it was kind of a pivotal moment in that, that field of occupational health and safety. Even saying that, it took until the 1970s for OSHA and MSHA to come about as governmental authorities.
Right.
That being said, OSHA, mostly their regs are just adopted ANSI and ASTM best practice standards. You know, there's nothing really novel there. Even the early PELs are just adopted ACGIH TLVs. Same thing with MSHA. So it's not like those agencies invented anything. They just had the authority to go about enforcing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's had some good effect, some negative effect. It's always push and pull. But the state of occupational health, I think, when it comes to OSHA, is certainly more safety related, because that's where the fatalities, the immediate outrage, the reactionary expectation is. You know, when a crane collapses in New York, it's all about crane safety for the next, mm-hmm. you know, 6 months. When a mine, it, you know, explodes, it's all about, you know, how do we, you know, better protect miners. And I think where the industrial hygiene and even to the extent of health and safety generalists are concerned on the private side, there's a lot more that can be done preventatively through good communication with companies, explaining, being able to communicate risk, being able to communicate return on investment, you know, holding companies to their internal, not really standards, but their internal values that are promoted. That, you know, I always see this when I find it funny. Our workers are our most valuable resource, you know, and that's like, oh, the economy turned down because of inflation, so we're going to cut 20% of our workforce. And you're like, oh, you're cutting 20% of your most valuable resources, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So there's a balance there, right? And we, as occupational health and safety professionals, have the ability to be that communicator between, you know, hey, this is what we say that we believe in as a company. This is what we need to do to live up to that. And then kind of hold the feet to the fire. Part of the problem with that is we're scientists. We are not great communicators.
not in the way that is needed for that.
Right. We're not PR people.
Right.
So my time at the emergency response company, I learned a lot about communication. There's a lot of great information out there. And some of it's, I don't know, let's see, it's not manipulative, but it's framing. So like, if you're going to have a meeting with a community, and there's been an incident in their area, a train derailment, a pipeline release, a chemical plant fire, something outrageous has occurred that in the community's mind should not have occurred. And you're going to hold a briefing and you're going to tell people what you believe the real risk is in relation to their felt experience. You know, mm-hmm. I smell this. It's got to be bad for me. Yeah, it probably is. If you were exposed to it long enough and a high enough concentration and so on and so forth. But if you hold that meeting in a church, people are much less likely to get out of control because of the environment, as opposed to if you hold it in a school or in another public location, you know, just because the idea of it's a church, you know. And so there are things that we can do. And one of my professors in uni was very, a popular fan of Peter Sandman. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Peter Sandman. He talks a lot about risk communication. Yeah. Is a lot more popular in the 90s than he is now, but his material is still just as good. And he talks about how we take the outrage out of, you know, communications. I use it with my team in talking about customers. Like, we screw up, customer's pissed, and they want to take their business somewhere else. The first thing you can do to lower that level of outrage is to take ownership of it and just say, yeah, we screwed up. And here's what we're going to do to make sure that that doesn't happen again. And here's what we're going to do to help us move on from here to there, help make things right with you. Lowering that level of outrage helps to de-escalate those situations. Doesn't make them go away. Doesn't mean the problem didn't happen, but just taking ownership of it. And I mean, think of the BP oil spill, right? What was one of the first thing that happened was the CEO of BP went out there and made some comment about the little people and how we care about the little people. It was like that just skyrocketed the outrage in that conversation. So, and he was gone shortly after that, so there's ways to, so I think the state of it is there's a regulatory side. And then there's the private side, and there's a way that we can work together better. And we can, I think OSHA has its place, but it's mainly focused on the outrageous. And the private side, we're trying to protect people from the thing that will hurt them 30 years from now. That's a difficult conversation.
No, I think that's actually very good framing and a very good way to look at it. I mean, I've had some. Done some analysis and looked at some stuff from OSHA, and I agree. It is the things that are, I'll say, the outrage at the moment that obviously gets the focus. One thing I've seen also is from a lot of people that were well experienced from the 90s and early 2000s from OSHA have now retired, and there's a whole new group of people in there. They don't have the institutional knowledge that people had of what was really going on or not going on from a health kind of safe health perspective, from protecting those people against potential health problems. So I think there's lots that, as you said, can be done bringing us in and having us help you understand maybe the new crop of people saying, listen, this is why we're doing things the way we do them, to kind of share our experience with them and our knowledge from an industrial hygiene kind of side.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've been deposed by an OSHA attorney before in a fall protection case. On our side, we felt like, they were being overly punitive for the incident that occurred. They were really trying to say that my client in particular was not, was egregious in their non-compliance. And we were able to show them, look, here's inspection records, here's, storage practices, here's, we're not trying to make anything up here. This all exists. But having this particular citation affects their ability to, and they're a good operator in this space. They had this incident, yes, but it doesn't appear to be systemic. Even the manufacturer of the device doesn't have any information related to this particular kind of failure. It's sort of novel. There's nothing egregious in what happened with our client, other than the fact that the person was severely injured. That's terrible. But let's have a conversation about this. And it ended up positively for our client. The OSHA attorney was how attorneys can get in their questioning. They're looking for inconsistencies. They're looking for places to catch you up so that your particular point of view is invalidated. And that's just the legal process. I don't hold that against, attorneys. That's how it works. But it also is something that says to scientists like us to say to our companies, look, there's a reason why we need to keep this record. There's a reason why we need to make sure that this is done consistently and recorded that we did it. If we have a quarterly meeting that's required or an annual review that's required, let's just make sure that we have it documented and that we've got a system that's robust. Because if this does come up, missing one of those will be enough to undermine the entire program.
Oh, no, I completely agree. And that's why I tell clients, there's reasons why we do things, and this is one of them. So, I mean, it is, We have that experience and expertise, and that's why we're giving you the best information we can to help you out in the long run.
Yeah, I'm always amazed at how often as a consultant I would be called into a company to help them assess a particular situation. And you just walk into the obvious issues. Like, I've never been here before, but that's a problem. That's a problem. And that's a problem, you know, like, but it's obvious that you think it's just normal, you know?
Right.
Why do you have formaldehyde in the air? Because your exhaust duct is leaking, because the liquid's on the floor, you know, like, so, you know, sometimes that's frustrating as a, you know, scientist. You know, you've got this investigative, ooh, let's figure out what, you know, what the mystery is behind this, you know, some sort of mysterious vapor intrusion, and you show up and it's just like plain as day, you know? So I can empathize with a government agency inspector that, you know, shows up to do their job and the place is just a housekeeping nightmare, you know, it's a fire hazard. And they just, you know, they're wanting to make sure that, you know, they've got their emphasis program, whether it's fall protection, whether it's respiratory protection, whatever it happens to be that particular time. And then they walk into just these nightmares. And I empathize with them. It's not an easy task. They're underfunded. There's nowhere near enough inspectors to do a meaningful percentage of the inspections that are needed to really force change.
I agree. Yeah.
But to your earlier point, the original OSHA guys, the guys that were all like, we're, you know, I'm sure a ton of, and let's say boomers, who came out of the 60s, wanted to, you know, save the world and everything. And then they got this government agency power to get behind them. And they did it 70s, 80s, even through the 90s, really making change. And then into the 2000s, they start to go away and they're getting a new crop of people, not cut from the same cloth necessarily, certainly good people, but they just don't have that depth of expertise that I think came in all at once when those agencies were founded. And
right.
So sometimes I see some of the newer inspectors, they show up and they're not following a process. They're not, you know, they're just like doing wipes off of surfaces. They're not measuring the area that they're wiping, and they're just right. Doing like detection. Like, well, what are you going to write that you detected it? What does it mean? You know, like, right. What are you doing? What are you going to write up on my client here? If there's no standard to compare your results to, you've got no,
I completely agree. And the way, so another topic I wanted to bring up with you is the way things are going, the way things are changing and progressing here, especially with COVID. What are your thoughts on the industrial hygienists kind of being the go-to voice for indoor environmental quality issues? You know, what are you seeing at your laboratory? What are you seeing just kind of in general from questions that you get from people wanting analysis done?
Yeah, I think let me say it this way. At the laboratory, we answer a lot of questions. Now, we're not in the consulting business, but we happen to have a lot of experienced customer service operations and salespeople who can answer questions, and people have come to rely on that. We have a lot of customers who don't ask us questions because they're good at what they do. There's a lot of people, particularly as the state of industrial hygiene is changing, where there's a lot less industrial hygienists going into the field, and where they are going into the field, they're going overseas. I've seen as much as half of the new CIHs that are minted each year are minted in China or India, not here in the United States. So even if the number were higher, we still are having a deficit here in the U.S. So that means that there are more and more generalists being asked to take this stuff up, environment people, safety people. You know, they aren't truly trained industrial hygienists, whether at the, you know, 4-year undergrad or the master's level. And so they have a ton of questions just because they don't have the background. And so we see most of the new customers that come in asking a lot more questions, needing a lot more handholding, which is something we're good at. But at the same time, you know, it does take time to have those conversations. Right. So not everybody's able to, whether they have the depth and experience. And so I think, particularly through COVID, industrial hygienists were quickly, within the first 2 months, kind of pushed aside in favor of the public health people. And mm-hmm. this was really our domain, you know. And then it got political. You know, and once it got political, it was too hard to recover from. You know, everybody became a virology expert. Everybody became a PPE expert.
Indoor air quality expert.
Yeah. Indoor air quality expert. Everything. And it was just like, no, you saw a presentation, you saw some YouTube, and you liked the way the guy said it, so you're going to just parrot what he said.
Right.
And that was frustrating. One of my early presentations was a refresher on the different types of PPE, you know, what kind of masks and respirators were appropriate for what kinds of situations, just to set the groundwork for the 65 countries we were supporting from our company in Switzerland. At the very, you know, what is the nature of this protective equipment and what can it actually do and what are its limitations? Mm-hmm. And then very quickly, the public health side just ran with whatever was politically expedient and expected and parroted everything that came out of the WHO. And yeah, I have to admit, I was not pleased with some of the stuff that came out of AIHA. And you know, I just, I'm like, this is 70 years of industrial hygiene, you know, Alice Hamilton's legacy that we're just brushing aside because it's politically expedient, instead of letting the voices who should be able to be the locus of control at the, you know, the application for what was going on at my business was different than what would go on at your business, you know, and you may take a different approach. For example, I had a guy call me, he was our facilities manager for a building, and he's like, hey, so I'm going to bring in the cleaning crew and double the cleaning shifts on all the surfaces. I'm like, why? We got 10% of the people in the office. You know, like, if anything, you should be letting them go, you know, and reducing the amount of cleaning, because, you know, it just those sorts of interventions you were constantly having to bat down, you know, the spray booths, you know, should everyone walk through a spray tunnel before they come to work? And oh my gosh, no.
Do you see the way things are going for the one states enacting indoor air quality rules or laws? Do you see the industrial hygienist playing that pivotal role, or do you see us still kind of playing catch up in that go-to voice for the indoor environmental quality space?
I see us as being pivotal to that conversation, but we have to insert ourselves in it. And it's difficult when you're working for a private company and then you're being very opinionated on something that is outside of your role, right? There's always a risk there. But I think that that's a risk that we have to take as a unified voice to say, in the industrial hygiene world, we should be part of this conversation. And you see it when it's not an emergency, right? So when Colorado went heavy on putting their cannabis legalization process in place, their legislation actually requires evaluation and sign-off by CIHs. And I think that that's a good move, whatever mm-hmm. you think about the cannabis industry. But it's, you know, solvent extraction, and there's potential for explosive atmospheres. And so, you know, there had to be an involvement of a CIH from the legislation level. And I thought that that was a good move because it keeps us involved. It keeps us, you know, mandatorily being used. We're not optional. We're not just a suggestion science. Right. You know, we're actually part of, if you want to do this right and you want to do it in a way that is applicable to the particular industry or situation, you need to talk to us, because one size mask does not fit all.
Right? And I think you're right there is, you know, we, and I like to bring this up, and it's the next topic I kind of want to talk about is, you know, the name of this podcast is the Exposure Scientist Podcast. We're scientists. You know, I think that's something that not everyone remembers about their this role. And I don't mean to diminish in any way, but, you know, I a lot of people in certain industries I've seen have, you know, the health people, industrial hygienists, have been reduced down to the safety people. And then the safety people have been reduced down to the security team. And it's just like, you know, we're scientists. We do scientific evaluations. So one of the things, and I'll ask you about this, has been an effort in recent years to rebrand industrial hygienists as the occupational and environmental health and safety professionals. That kind of tries to get away from the terminology industrial hygienist, because of course, whenever you ask someone what they think industrial hygienists do, they show you a picture of someone sitting in a dental chair or something. Where do you see that rebranding effort? And do you think it's still good to either remind people that we are industrial hygienists and we are exposure scientists? Or do you see some kind of dilution of the profession by calling ourselves OEHS professionals?
Yeah. Yeah, I see that. Boy, you had a lot in that. Let me try to unpack that a bit.
Sure. I know I gave you a lot.
You gave me a lot. So calling us OH&S, occupational health, you know, safety professionals, I get that we're throwing a larger tent out there. Mm-hmm. And why does this happen? It happens because a lot of times if you hire a hygienist at your company, initially they're just doing industrial hygiene. But then there's always a steady state that the program goes into, and that person's got some time on their hands. And so then they get pulled into, hey, can you, because we are a bit of jacks of all trades, so it's kind of our fault, right?
Right.
We get touched in everything. I know you're a PhD tox. I used to tease my PhD tox colleagues at the emergency response company. I'm like, hey man, it's not my fault that you got a PhD in a subset of what I do. That's just, I took a tox class, right? But I took a lot of other classes too.
Yeah.
But no, it's about those people end up taking on different roles. They end up taking the drug and alcohol program. They might end up taking some environmental. I mean, even in my global role doing industrial hygiene, I ended up owning fugitive dust, which is traditionally an environmental kind of thing. So we get pulled into these things. And then on the opposite side too, a company may not have an industrial hygienist, but they've got lots of environmental people or safety people. So then they get given those responsibilities, and then their choices are either learn to do it as best you can, or hire outside, which is always more expensive. As a consultant, we were never cheap. So,
right.
You know, that's what creates the need for the tent. I don't think it's a good thing. And here's why. When I talked about that fall protection incident, when I was, and as it goes to your point about exposure science versus we are scientists, the OSHA attorney, there was the way the fall protection thing worked is it was traveling down a cable at a high rate of speed, and it eventually engaged as it was designed to, and where it caught that cable, it left an indention, and then the piece of equipment exploded. As I reviewed the cable, I noticed that the piece of, you know, the machinery of the fall protection equipment matched the area where, you know, it was some distance from the end, and we said, okay, this was the area of impact because it was consistent with this deformation. And the OSHA attorney's like, are you a metallurgist? And I'm like, no, ma'am, but I am a scientist and I'm trained to make observations. And I saw my attorney on the outside of the corner of my eye go like, yeah, because we're trained to make observations. We're not saying that. You know, I wasn't saying anything metallurgically about the steel, other than there was an obvious connection between a part of the thing and the cable where it was deformed, and they fit.
You generated a hypothesis.
I generated a hypothesis that was testable. Yeah. Would you like to look at the cable and tell me where else is likely that this failure occurred? Mm-hmm. You know, there was only one spot. So I wasn't, you know, I was just making an observation, and that was yeah. key to that. And so that's where we're useful is as scientists is really on this investigatory quality of going in and determining what is most likely and then testing it, right? We do that when we do exposure assessments. We walk in, we're like, you've got this chemical and this operation and these people, and they're here for this much time. Let's monitor some of them, because I think this is an area where exposures might occur. And then we get the results back, and it either verifies what our hypothesis was, or it's, you know, we've established it's a null. So
right.
That's, I think, the important thing to maintain in our branding. Industrial hygiene's always been a weird term for me. And I always tease my dental hygienist whenever I go in. I'm like, I'm a hygienist too. But having that international experience, the international term is occupational hygiene. And I thought, at least that says job, right? Industrial says industry,
right,
which doesn't really describe anything.
Exposure science covers a broad subject area, including toxicology, industrial hygiene, and risk assessments. From occupational, community, or environmental exposure, exposure scientists apply scientific methodologies to understand exposure risks and apply controls when necessary. We at Exposure Assessment Consulting have this expertise. Please reach out to us at info@exposureconsulting.com for a free 15-minute consultation to discuss the specifics of your exposure scenario.
Yeah, I'll say what makes it harder, and I think they tried to do this, and I'll get your thoughts on this, but while you say environmental, you know, I'll say recent, within the last 15 to 20 years, you know, there's been more of a focus on the industrial hygienist contributing to and evaluating community exposures as well. You know, we have that skill set to evaluate what health risks are outside the occupation, whether it's people entering a store, you know, people that are in a school. Obviously, there are people that are employed there, but there are also students there as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that I'll say makes it, I don't say confusing when you talk about industrial hygiene. Well, with this, we're not in an industrial setting. Why are you opining on community settings? Well, even OSHA says the IH can look at the community exposures as well. So sure. I think that's where a shift has been. I've seen that shift want to move to community settings. Do you have any experience or thought on, again, I know you deal with emergency response, so the applicability of the IH for community exposures as well?
Yeah, as long as we're recognizing that there's a different set of standards, you know, TLVs, OELs, PELs, those are related around, you know, typically occupational type exposures. So what are you exposed to in your workplace? However, as an industrial hygienist, when I worked for the oil and gas side, we had fugitive emissions from, we had produced water. Right, we come up out of the wells with the gas containing some level of hydrocarbon, and we would try to recover that hydrocarbon, and then we had this water that we had to dispose of. Well, in Pakistan, right, the preferred method for disposal was evaporation. So we had evaporation ponds, and it was just keeping it mixed up and letting the sun do its thing and the water and everything dissipating. Well, carrying in that evaporation is some level of hydrocarbon, benzene in particular. And our facility had a boundary, and there was a village here and a village here right up against the fence. As an industrial hygienist, I had to look at that and say, okay, what is the acceptable fence line level that would potentially expose this community if the wind was prevailing in their direction for a period of time? What would be acceptable? And I have to go and find a 24-hour, you know, a toxicology, maybe look at the emergency response. Was it the Eagles, the
AEGLs.
Yeah. AEGLs, sorry. Yeah. And look at that and try to make some applicable adjustment. Because the other side of it is, you know, are you going to move the village? Are you going to displace?
We can engineer that out.
Well, you know, or are you going to, you know, if it's severe enough, are you going to change from an evaporation process to a disposal well, pump it back into the, you know, into the ground? And that, of course, is a capital investment. But the way that you come to those decisions, and I think we're industrial hygienists, occupational science, exposure scientists, have the ability to do that, is to give the data that's actionable. This is what exists, and this is these are your options. And then it becomes easier, I think, at the higher levels to then say, okay, we'll put capital towards this one because the risk level is X or Y. The community outrage of moving a village, all you got to do is look through history. Anytime you displace the local people for your industrial practices, and see how much goodwill is generated in such a practice, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of things that go into it, and that's why I circle back around to this. Yes, we're scientists, but we also need to be able to communicate the results of what we get and
communicate results and communicate risk. Yeah. Which I know is. It is difficult because, again, you know, I'm talking to people and understanding, hey, you know, it depends on which group you're talking to. Are you talking to people in the community? Or are you talking to like the C-suite people? Because you have to use different language, different terminology that they will understand to communicate that. So have you, it sounds like you have, but, you know, I'll let you talk a little more on it. Have you had the opportunity to, you know, I'll say a vertically integrated issue where you had to use one set of language or communication to the community versus another way to communicate to the upper echelon in the company based on the risk that they potentially could have created from the scenario that you were addressing?
A bunch of times. Because it comes up a lot, especially as a consultant, right? If you're brought in on an emergency, you've got regulators to talk to, you've got deep pocket C-suite people to talk to, you've got the community to talk to. But probably the one that was most communication intensive, and this is one that it came in the door to us when I was doing the emergency response company. I was still doing industrial hygiene, but it came in the door as really a, we're having trouble selling our message to our team about their risk. But where this was happening was at a nuclear waste treatment and disposal site in Washington State. And they were they were a prime contractor working under DOE to handle this, you know, legacy of the Cold War nuclear site. Hundreds and hundreds of workers on site. They got more education than you can think of, right? I mean, I've been through the hiring practice there, the onboarding, and it is deep in letting people know the education behind it. But the day-to-day risks are very difficult to communicate. And so then their state attorney general is suing them because they're putting workers at risk. The local news station is running hit pieces on them because they're finding a sympathetic voice. This guy's sick. Obviously, these people don't care. And they came to us and they're like, please come help us communicate. And of course, as being an emergency response thing, everybody there, it seemed like, and I'm not saying I was the genius in the room, but on the calls that we got and the communications that we had, I think we all heard, we need you to come measure, because that's what we did, right? If you ask a doctor to, you know, hey, I've got this owie, he's going to start treating you because that's what doctors do, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, if you go ask your dad about your owie, he says, well, don't touch it anymore. You know, don't do that again, right? He gives you different advice than the doctor does. So, but I heard it as, we need you to help come communicate. And so I went and talked to my boss. I'm like, can we go get this as an industrial hygiene job? And he's like, all right, let's go internally work that out. And then I wrote up the proposal. We're going to send some people up here. Here's what we're going to do. And we sent some people up there, did the initial, here's what we can help you do, kind of understand what was happening on the ground. And then it fell back to me and my big mouth. And I had to go up on the next rotation to take the next part of this study going forward. And I walked into a room and there were two of us, me and a junior guy. and like 30 people. There were DOE people. There were all the prime contractor C-suite people. There were all of the, you know, the union guys were there. And they're like, tell us about what you're going to do. And what we had recognized in that initial information gathering was that they had all the monitoring in the world. They had 20 years of monitoring data. They had 2 million data points, but they didn't have anybody who was communicating what it meant. And I said to that room, you have a great story here and nobody's telling it. You've invested millions of dollars to quantify these problems. You understand what's inside each one of these waste tanks. You know to the billionth part what comes out. You know, and so all of these things, you just need somebody who's an objective third party who can explain this in a way that both sides are happy, that the union people feel like they can go to work safely, and that the contractor feels like they're going to be able to establish a timeline for getting this project done, because if the work's not moving, you don't know when you're going to finish. Right. And then the DOE regulator was able to feel like they were okay. This seems to be in good hands. As that turned into a multi-million dollar education process, where we just sent PhD talks and IHs up there and engaged with the workforce at their morning meetings. We're just there to answer questions. What does it mean when I smell this smell or that smell? And we talked about odor thresholds, and it just was this huge communication project. Now, did the problem go away 100%? No, of course not. But it got better and it moved on.
Yeah.
And that was one of my favorite projects, because it was this opportunity to be a hygienist, but you weren't monitoring, but you were interpreting data and communicating. And that was hugely impactful.
Yeah, no, that is a great story. That is a great example of where we excel based on our skill set. So I appreciate you sharing that. Thanks.
Yeah.
So based on your, I'll say, your history that you've explained today, your experience working at Bureau Veritas, as your director of sales for the laboratory, can you kind of tell us where you see the future of industrial hygiene, where you see the future of even monitoring activities, especially with, you know, the use of all these different sensors, these remote monitoring sensors popping up left and right from who knows where? Where do you see us going with sampling? Where do you see us go with health and safety? Where do you see us going as industrial hygienist as a practice?
So I took my kids last night, their last day of spring break, to go see the new Ghostbusters movie. Mm-hmm. And I was reminded that when I was 10, the first Ghostbusters movie came out. And there's a scene where Peter Venkman goes to Dana Barrett's apartment, and he has this big suitcase thing thrown over his shoulder, and it's got a tube and a squeeze bulb on it. It's got a wand, and he's going around. He's like, yeah, I'm just not getting anything. It was decades later, I found out that was an old piece of industrial hygiene equipment. That was some sort of a air sampling, you know, like, so here I was 10 years old, seeing my future profession in one of my favorite movies of all time. I love where technology has taken the field. I love that pumps are getting smaller. I love that dosimeters no longer have $200 cords you have to replace every time they get ripped out of the mic. I love that progression. But like with all technologies, there's just a level of proof that we've got to, it's got to demonstrate its ability to be repeatable, verifiable, you know, and then the people that use it have got to understand it. Just like if you use gas detection sensors and you're measuring for carbon monoxide, you also have to be aware if there's a source of hydrogen nearby, because there's a cross sensitivity there. And you may not be measuring CO, you may be measuring hydrogen. And if you have a bunch of lead acid batteries charging, that's not a good place to zero out your carbon monoxide meter, right? And that takes somebody that has that level of knowledge to be able to implement that technology correctly.
Right.
So happy to see the movement in sensors. I've interviewed some people on my own podcast that are in the tech space. I love it. And I'd love to see how AI could help us cross some of the bridges on the experience gap as we have less and less hygienists and more generalists doing things like exposure assessments, particularly if it's based on existing data. You know, we can teach these things to make good initial qualitative assessments, and then we can kind of take it from there. I think there's really cool opportunities there. So sensors are great. They've just got to be proven. It's like badges, passive badges versus active sampling. Which one's better? Well, it depends on your application and depends on the person who's putting it out there and what result they're looking for, what they're trying to measure. That's the art. Right. Of it, right? It's the art of the application.
And I think it's the art, not only the application, but understanding the data, interpreting the data. You know, these sensors generate a lot of data. Who, like you said, who's looking at it? How are they interpreting it? And is it the best way for them to be interpreting it?
Yeah. You know, huge. And, you know, I became an early adopter when some of the bright minds at AIHA were really getting into the Bayesian statistics side of things. And where I looked at it from was when I went into my first job, the hygienist there was monitoring everyone for the same three things, regardless of their job. And it was a lot of extra sampling. Mm-hmm. And with the statistics, I was able to take the data that we had and say, okay, now this group, this exposure group only needs to be sampled this frequently and only for these things, and basically reduced the sampling load by about 70%. And then was able to take that extra 70% and focus on other things that we weren't looking at the time, because it's easy to do your exposure assessment once and kind of consider it done, when really it should be an iterative cycle. And I think that's where hygienists getting lost in doing other types of things, they never get a chance to come back to their original exposure assessment and reassess it. And usually what happens is it doesn't get reassessed until that person moves on to a different job and someone else inherits their exposure assessment. Goes, I can't make heads or tails of this. I'm just going to throw it out and start over.
I've done that many times in consulting. You know, they say, yeah. Oh, we've had these people do it. And you look at it and say, why did they do that?
Yeah. You're like, what is that?
I'm like, we're not doing it like that, kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think that, there's a lot of good opportunity and, in the new technology and opportunity for industrial hygienists to be cross. And look, being a CIH doesn't mean you know everything. Being a CIH means you pass the test to a minimum level, right? You've got nowhere to go but up from there. Right. And, again, no knock on, smart guys like yourself. But I had a colleague who had a PhD toxicology, and he had taken the test and got his CIH, and then was asked to give a presentation on implementing an exposure program at a large company. And my boss came and asked me, he's like, do you think Dr. So-and-so could give this presentation? I'm like, yeah, I'm sure he could. Has he ever done it? I've done it. I could write the presentation for him and he could give it, but just because he has CIH doesn't mean that he's actually worked in a company and implemented a global industrial hygiene program, So
right.
There's still opportunity for us to grow, and we should never stop learning as industrial hygienists. And we shouldn't necessarily shy away from doing things on the safety side or the environmental side. But we should also make ourselves more available to people in those fields. I'm a big fan of mentoring and sharing the knowledge that we have, because if we don't, who will? Who will teach the 20-year safety guy how to do better exposure assessment, short of him going and getting some education somewhere, going and taking PDCs from, additional education classes from AIHA or from the BCSP. But one of the things I wanted to come back to was on the rebranding. I was there when the American Society of Safety Engineers changed their name to the American Society of Safety Professionals.
Yeah.
And I know why they did that. because they always got a lot of criticism that they weren't true engineers, right? But I thought it said a lot more about the profession than safety professional. I was against the change. I was a delegate and I went there and voted against it. I know why they did it. Again, that wider tent. I think that an engineer title holds a lot more weight in people's minds when it comes to, oh, this guy's certified by the, you know, American Society of Safety Engineers, you know, or belongs to the American Society of Safety Engineers. I think that that's where AIHA and I guess what was the American Board of Industrial Hygiene, I think that's kind of where they need to go. They need to look, and I love the term exposure scientist, which I that's actually how I found your podcast. I was searching that term and it popped up because we are, we're scientists, right? I think scientists hold the same gravitas as engineer professional. McDonald's managers are professionals, you know, like your HR people are professionals. There's a lot of professionals. Professionals includes engineers, you know? So I think it just muddies the water a little bit and it doesn't give the same level of public gravitas to what we're actually doing. It's just the same way as you wouldn't want doctors to be called health professionals. You know,
no, I agree. I mean, it I don't say it. You said it muddies the water. I will agree with that. You know, I don't want to say it dilutes what we do, but I think it's important to remind people that we're exposure scientists. You know, when I do public outreach, you know, whenever, even when I'm speaking on for at AIHA events or on behalf of AIHA for something they invite me to speak, I say, listen, we're exposure scientists. We need to remember that. You know, for mentoring, and I mean, I'm trying, you know, I think we all try our best. I try my best to go out and do things like every year my kid's school has a teach-in event where they can come in there and teach about what you do. And I say, I am an exposure scientist. You know, I tell the kids, you know, this is something you can be interested in. Other people, you know, I hear say, I'm an occupational environmental health and safety professional. And I can imagine the kids' eyes glossing over going, all right,
words.
I don't know. Right. Yeah. But if you get them excited about science, one thing that they do every day, they're going to remember it. And they're going to say, you know what, I want to grow up to be a scientist. And my son says he wants to be a scientist. I'm like, you know, there's more than science than just mixing beakers together and watching something blow out of the top. You know, there's different facets of science. And this is one of the best facets that we can do that has a wide range of applicability based on our skill set. And reminding people that we're not just there to, I'll say, be regulatory compliant officers. We are there as scientists to help protect people's health. And that's a hard message to get across, again, as you said, especially with rebranding or the want to dilute kind of what we do.
Yeah. So let me give this personal aside. I struggled with weight for most of my adult life, and administrative controls just weren't working. Right. No amount of things I could write down were going to stop the calories going into my face. And so with the encouragement of my spouse, I went to Tijuana and I got the stomach reduction. And you know what? You lose weight when you can't eat.
Yeah, so I bet.
I went right to engineering controls, right? Like, let's fix this problem. Yeah. Right. Because all of the, you know, administrative and, you know, substitutions, like I'm going to do keto, you know, like, yeah, it works for a minute. But if you really want to fix the risk, you know, sometimes you got to do something radical. You've got to really implement what needs to be implemented to actually make the change. So, you know, I walk and talk the principle. We're exposure scientists. Our job is to assess what is likely to occur, determine if it's occurring or not occurring, and then make recommendations. And then really where I'd like to see us change some of our approach is have the ability to be the implementer, to sit with the planning side and say, you know, every company has X amount of CapEx set aside for health improvements, you know, and be part of that. And I've seen some of it. I've seen scorecards, you know, that have, you know, safety is 30% of the, you know, annual bonus and that sort of thing. But that's usually around not killing someone.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great place for us to be. I say, you know, even from the environmental, indoor environmental quality side, you know, when you're designing a building, whatever it is, get us there at the early stages so we could take a look and say, that's probably not the best thing for you to be doing building this facility. You know, get us in there early because we have the expertise, again, anticipating and recognizing the problem is where we excel. So, you know, let us.
I did that once and it cost a guy his job. I was involved in a we'd had some similar issues with some facilities with this particular customer. They were building a new facility and they were putting in a gas detection system as part of this new build. And we were part of their design committee. And we're like, I think that this is a waste of your money and you should not do this. You should consider other options. And they ignored our advice. As consultants, they were paying us to get our advice and ignore it, which I thought was amazing. I wish I could get more of that work. And so what happens? I told him, I said, in 6 months after you open this facility, you'll have turned this system off. And sure enough, their problem reemerged within the first year of being open. We went down there. The system was turned off because it alarmed and they didn't know what it meant and they didn't know what to do about it. And they spent $330,000 on a system that they didn't use. And so when this whole thing unraveled, the guy who was ultimately the head safety guy at that company, he was the first one to go. I feel bad for him, but
right,
that guy needed to stand up and say, no, we paid these guys to make this recommendation, just like we paid the people who do in the structural build, you know, to make sure the roof doesn't fall down. These guys are here to say this is, you know, the direction that we should go with this this chemical detection system. And if you choose to ignore them at your peril. And no, luckily, in this case, it was just a loss of money and this one guy's job. And nobody, you know, it wasn't like a fire protection system and this building burned down or something like that. But, it's same thing. It was still $250,000 that could have been used somewhere else.
Right. No, I laugh, but I mean, it's experience that I have seen that plenty of people seen, and, you know, people pay us for our opinions and our opinions are based on our experience. And when those opinions are ignored, even though, again, as you said, it seems to be a good gig to get paid and just, you know, just for giving opinions no one listens to, it does have problems. And, you know, I have seen it where, as you said, and maybe that's a bigger cultural issue at a company where someone doesn't stand up for it, or they want to seem like the one who is right and knows more than the people you're being brought in. There's lots of different reasons, but I like to remind people of this is like, you know, we're all on the same team. You know, we're doing, you know, if I'm doing a mold assessment and I'm overseeing remediation, you know, I'm telling the remediators, we're all on the same team here. I'm not trying to get you in trouble or trying to say you're doing things wrong. We're just trying to do things correctly, you know, and for the best for the client, and reminding people. And again, it could be a difference in culture at the company or organization or what have you, but we have a common goal. And I think that's important to always understand.
Well, it was a lot more expensive to turn off that system and then bring my company back to monitor by handheld systems for months and months on end.
I can only imagine
to do it right the first time. And, you know, I was the beneficiary of them doing it the wrong way. And like I said, it wasn't something that was immediately harmful to people. So that's a good thing. But man, what a better place you would be in if you'd have done it right from the beginning. Always easier to do it right in the first place than to retrofit. You
know? Right. Or at least if you're going to do what happened, learn from your mistakes and don't do it again, you know, grow from them. Whether it's that company or another company or somebody that's listening to this, understand that, hey, you know, maybe we shouldn't make that, you know, $350,000 mistake here. Maybe we should do things differently and listen to the guys who know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Dan Christensen, thank you so much for joining us on today's episode of the Exposure Scientist Podcast. I think we covered a lot of great things, and we appreciate your insight and expertise. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here. It's very nice to have met you.
You too. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening to the Exposure Scientist Podcast. You can connect with us at our website, exposureconsulting.com, where you can book a private consultation and send in any questions regarding any episodes or our guests. See you on the next episode.